Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Questlove Supreme. I'm your host, Questlove. With me is Laia, quarantining from the West Coast. Hello.
Hello. Hey, everybody. I miss you and hug you.
Sugar Steve from the top of his building in Manhattan.
Petri Dish Central.
Where you at, unpaid Bill?
Westchester. We're neighbors.
Okay. So I can visit?
Yeah, come on over. You can hang out with Frickin' Frack. It's the whole thing.
Laia, don't approve of that. Montigolo, where you broadcasting from now, bro?
From the crib, Raleigh, North Carolina.
Okay, keeping it real. Ladies and gentlemen, this episode has been long, long overdue. You know, it's a rarity that anyone in hip-hop culture can have sustainability and change with the times and still stay themselves.
Big facts.
In this culture without hitting a landmine. And our guest today I call him Teflon Joe. I
mean, me and my buddies have a saying, if a nuclear bomb went off, the last two rappers standing would be Fat Joe and Busta Rhymes. Straight up. Straight up. Y'all brothers done survived everything, man.
Ladies and gentlemen, yeah, let's welcome the one and only the god, Fat
Don
Joe.
Don Cartagena.
Exactly. Exactly. Don Cartagena to Questlove Supreme.
Thank you so much.
How you making out in this current environment, sir?
Me, I'm just, you know, I'm happy to be home, man. I'm happy to be home, man. I've been on the road for 25 years, man, and the fact that I'm able to be with the family and spend time at home with my daughter, my wife, and everybody, man, I'm actually enjoying it, to be honest with you.
Where is home currently? You're a Jersey resident right now, correct?
No. I live in Miami. I've been in Miami for like 17 years.
I've always known you as, I've always known you as a Jersey resident. I didn't know that you moved to Miami.
Yeah. I lived in the Bronx my whole life, and then I moved to Jersey. My wife forced me to move to Jersey because I didn't want to leave the Bronx. And she was like, if you don't move, I'm leaving you. So I had to go to Jersey, which was the smartest thing I ever did in my life. So when I went to Jersey, I finally heard birds chirping and little kids playing in the street. And then eventually at one time I got so frustrated with like the New York hip hop scene that I moved down to Miami. And that's when, you know, that's around the time I met DJ Khaled before he was, you know, when he was just an underground DJ, and Kool & Dre. And just the love down here, the camaraderie and the love was just so much different from what was going on in New York. So I had came down here for a fresh start and been down here ever since.
Okay.
Around what time was that when you went to Miami?
Man, that's like 17 years ago. You know, I always said, you know, one day, you know, when I started out digging in the crates. And if you go to them early videos, if you would go engine number 9 on that US, I'm one of the guys jumping in the background.
Oh, word?
I was in everybody's video. Yes, I was in everybody's video. Everybody was in my video. We worked with each other. We didn't look at each other as competition. It was all love when I came up. And then once money came into play, everybody started having their own clique, and everybody thought they was bigger than the other one. And that's how New York got separated. And then one day I was in my home in New Jersey, and I was fed up with it already. But I was listening to the radio, and I heard Cam'ron say he'll smack the koofy off of Nas's head. And that's when I told my wife, pack up the vans, we out. We out of here. We can't be over here like this. I don't know what's going on with New York hip hop. Then we came down here and we started the Miami movement, like with the DJ Khaled, with the Pitbull, the Rick Ross, the Kool & Dre. You know, Kool & we set Dre. It off down here and made that camaraderie. And then when Lil Wayne, when Katrina happened, He came down to Miami, him and Birdman. We embraced him, and that's where you get all those records we was doing, like Taking Over, Brown Paper Bag.
In the Bronx, how would you describe your childhood for those that don't know your history in the Bronx?
Well, you from Philly,
yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's different parts of Philly. Mm-hmm. There's North Philly, South Philly, Allegheny, Germantown, this, that. Mm-hmm. So what I'm trying to make reference to that is, oh, he's from North Carolina, this Fayetteville, this Greensboro, this Charlotte, this.
Absolutely.
I'm from the Bronx, in the part where hip hop was created.
Right.
So what I'm trying to tell you is, there's many parts of the Bronx. So me as a little kid, I was watching Melly Mel and Grandmaster Flash play pickup games of basketball against Little Ikey C, Little Rodney C. You know, I grew up in, like, literally. So if you look at So Privileged, so Ruby D, who's the first Latino MC, he used to have a softball team. These guys never lost. I used to watch them play softball. I used to go to every jam. My brother was the way I fell in love with hip hop. My brother used to go to all the jams and bring me back the cassette tapes from all the Zulu Nation anniversaries or Kool Herc or whatever. And I used to listen to it so much, I thought I was actually in there. Mm-hmm. Like, they'd be like, back up from the ropes, back up from the ropes. Then they playing Mary, Mary, why you bugging? That funk is on.
Right.
And then they come back with, I don't know if you've been told, but Santa Claus is a black man, a black man. I'm in my room listening to these cassette tapes like, oh my fucking God. And just because I was too small to go. And then when they did it outside, I would go to outside. So I was privileged to be born in the soil. Like, just no other way to explain it to you. Like, I was blessed as a hip hop fan, as a hip hop fan, not just as a rapper or whatever.
Wow. So as far as like it calling you, I mean, were you rapping early as a kid or you just like, I'm a fan, but at what point is,
I wanted to be like,
at what point is it like, okay, I want to get involved in the culture.
It's different. It was, I was the culture. It's what I'm trying to tell you. I break dance. I wrote graffiti. Terror Squad is a graffiti crew.
Okay.
It started out off graffiti. Terror Squad.
So where were you tagging up at?
All over the Bronx, on the walls, on the train. When I got older, I would break out my house. I'm talking too much in front of my daughter right now, but I would break out my house when my parents would sleep, go hit the trains, and dangerous shit, like cops chasing us. Under the third rail, under like crazy shit. Come back to my house. My sister would open the door like 5 a.m, like, damn, man, like you might. And then, you know, when I wake up, you know, it's time for school, but writing graffiti, but rapping, I wanted to be like my brother. My brother was, you know, he used to rap, and I wanted to be like my brother. And so I started to rap. So I was writing maybe 9, 10 years old in my mother's table where everybody was like, what type of what am I doing? And I'm like, you know, I want to rap.
What was your MC name back then?
9, 10 years old. Oh, my name, my first name was Lil Pop.
Okay.
Lil Pop. And we were saying shit like Joey Rockwell and all that. And I had a little fake rhymes like Sneakers and Cheap. You know, something you could feel every rock. You could like I was just, you know, learning the game. But you know, it was real.
So, as far as like, in the area that you grew up, were there any other notable hip hop luminaries that we would know of today? Like, were you?
No, everybody
growing up with Lord Finesse as an 11-year-old, or like?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. So what happened was, so as I told you, it was a hip hop, Whippy Whip Wop, Starsky, all of them live in my block.
Right.
But when the guy who inspired me to rap was Lord Finesse. So I was already in the streets, hustling, doing all type of shit, you know, being, you know, a product of my environment in the worst way. And Finesse, he used to sell us papers. So back in the days, they would bring the newspaper. So Finesse would buy the newspaper at the store for a quarter, but he would sell it in the building for a dollar. He was an entrepreneur. So he would walk up and down the project building going, paper. And then my moms would give me a dollar. I go see Finesse. He make, not his real shit. And then he would make 75 cents and then give it back. But Finesse would always tell me like, yo, Joey, I'm going to be a rapper. I'm going to get on. And I'd be like, yeah, right. I locked the door. I'm like, man, he's so full of shit. And and one day I'm just listening to the radio, Red Alert. He's just playing the Funky Technician. He's playing all of Finesse. And I'm like, no way, Finesse made it. And that gave me, sometimes you got to see it. So that gave me the proof that we can actually make it out of the hood and actually become professional artists. And that's when I started, you know, really believing we could do something. And then also Diamond Dean used to write graffiti with me. And he would tell me all the time, yo, Joe, you're going to go to jail. You're going to get killed. You out here doing crazy shit. Y'all, like, bro, why don't you put all the shit you do in the streets into your music? And actually, even though I had money at the time, actually crazy money, he took me to the studio and paid for the session, Diamond, to like, you know, get me off the streets.
Wow.
And so we went in there and we made the demos. And then and one of them was FloJo, my first single. So I went, am I talking too long?
No. This
never. Nah, no. This is perfect. This is perfect.
Okay. So we went, we made like three demos in that first session. One of them was FloJo.
Right.
So I wanted to earn, even though I grew up with Showbiz and AG, I grew up with Diamond. They were already on. I wanted to earn my spot. So I went to Amateur Night at the Apollo and I performed that Amateur Night and I won it 4 weeks in a row.
Word?
And wow. To tell you the truth.
Wait, I got a question.
Yeah. That's how I got on.
I got a question because we rarely have actual Apollo Amateur Night contestants on the show.
People who survived the Apollo.
What is the true way to rig the system so that you win Amateur Night, the Apollo? Is it the people you bring with you, or like?
I can't tell you, Rick. I had some people in there, but it's the Apollo was like a stadium compared to the people. I might have brought 20 people came to see Fat Joe, but it's 2,000, 3,000 seats. But I'm going to tell you something.
Yeah.
And this is where no one can ask me if there's a God. You understand what I'm saying? Because as I went back, recently, maybe a year ago, I really thought about that Apollo. Like I said, all right, you went in Apollo. What do? So I went in there. It was 150 groups. And I remember looking at everybody saying, they don't have a chance. I don't know what they're doing here. I'm going to take this shit. Now, what's crazy is, if you want to talk about the elephant in the room, I was the only Latino in Black Harlem with 150 black groups.
Talk so about now, that.
No, and then, so when I think about it, how it went down, I just went out there. I had three girls from my projects, Michelle and Barbara and Niecy, and they came out with me, and they were standing behind me doing some fly shit, and I was walking through rapid. But, the people just went crazy. They couldn't hear a bar or nothing. They fucking went crazy. And every time I came out, they just went crazy. And it wasn't because of my lyrics. It wasn't because they just went crazy. And I say that was God in the room. He said, this is how you're going to do it. So I won 4 weeks. I met Red Alert. Red Alert was the biggest DJ in the planet Earth. Mm-hmm. It was only two DJs at the time that were considered mainstream. It's Red Alert and Mr. Magic.
Mr. Magic.
Yup, Mr. Magic, rest in peace. So Red Alert said, yo, do you have a demo? Can you give me a demo? So I gave him FloJo. About a month later, I had the flu. I was in the projects laying down, and the shit came on. And I jumped to the ceiling, how high I jumped. from the flu. I put the speaker on the window in the projects and told everybody, yo, Red Alert playing my shit. He playing. Everybody going crazy in front of the building. And then he kept playing that for like close to like 8 months every week. And then Chris Lighty, rest in peace, came to the hood where I hustled, my block, where I hustled.
Right.
And told me, yo, you Fat Joe? I was like, yeah. I was like, yeah. I was like, he said, you know who I am? I said, yeah, you Baby Chris. And he was like, yo, I want to sign you on a record deal. Like, I think you could be a superstar. And I signed in the middle of the street. And the rest was history.
You signed instantly to Relativity?
Yeah, I don't have no lawyer. No, I was a drug dealer. What do you want me to do, Quest?
No. I was just like, wow. That
I ain't got no interest.
That was speedy. So wait, that
and trust and trusting.
That answers my second question. So that's definitely you saying, fuck you talking about on Diamond D's.
I am in every ad lib on that album. That's my claim to fame. It's my fucking claim to fame. Fuck you talking about.
Yo, chill. Right.
Yo, that's that shit.
That is my fit, yo.
Yo, that's that shit.
Oh, that's you. You're the ad lib guy all over.
Yo, that's that
every
shit.
Every ad lib.
Yeah.
I am the ad lib in every song. I dare you to ask Diamond. That's my claim to fame.
Wait.
I was there for that whole album, the whole process.
Slight confession. Like, there was a point in my life where, you know, there wasn't enough bass in my voice to be cursing and really intimidating people. So shut up, Laia. Laia, like, oh, really? Man? No, I swear to God. Like, every time post 93. When I'm saying fuck you talking about, I'm literally just echoing Fat Joe.
Fuck you talking about. Fuck you talking about. Yo, chill.
That is my favorite cursing on record ever. But you were you not involved on the Jazzy J record at all? The compilation that he did?
Not a Jazzy J. No. I was from Diamond D on. But I knew Jazzy J. I did my whole first album in Jazzy J studio. But I'm not that. I think the compilation was before me.
So when did the official, like, the uniting of Digging in the Crates first occur? Like, was it then in 92?
I think I always Digging in the Crates. I'm from the projects. So I was Digging in the Crates. There's no way to explain it to you. Like, I grew up with Showbiz, grew up with Diamond D, grew up with Finesse. Hey, I'm rapping. I'm digging in the crates. I was, you know, getting a lot of money in the streets. Mm-hmm. And I was at first the fat Spanish guy that stands on stage behind Lord Finesse and Diamond D. and you looking like, who the fuck is the D-boy standing behind these motherfuckers iced out with the convertible Benz outside? Like, motherfuckers is like, that must be the big boy from the block. And, so people knew me from that, but I was always digging in the crates. I don't think there was an initial anointing. You know, I do remember we was at the Fever in the Bronx when I got asked, could we make OC Digging in the Crates? And OC was from Brooklyn.
Okay.
And I was like, hell yeah, man. He had the joint, you lack the minerals and vitamins. I ain't in the size.
Time's up.
Yeah, like I was like, yo, yeah, time's up. I was like, we better make that boy Digging in the Crates. And so I remember that.
And was Big L around this time period or?
Big L was there already. So Finesse had met Big L during the, Big L used to battle everybody on 125th in Harlem, across the street from the Apollo. Every day after school, Big L was just killing dudes. Finesse met him, put him on a remix, the Yes You May remix. So I was at the show the first time Big L ever rap at a show, and he destroyed that motherfucker. And I was like, oh shit. And they was like, yo, we signed, you know, Big L. I was like, big motherfucking L, D-I-T-C. He was incredible. It was like a Finesse on steroids. It was like, first of all, to me, Finesse was the best punchline lyricist at the time. Mm-hmm. And then he found, like, he found the bravo of the Superman, like Big L. So it was a no-brainer.
Right. So as far as the environment is now and what you're used to, like when you're doing concerts, I know that it was like night and day with a 25-year lapse in between. But what were your early shows like promoting on the road and like back in 92, like from 92 to like 95, like what was that like back then in the very beginning?
Well, you ever heard of Steve Lobel? You know Steve Lobel?
Yeah, Steve
Lobel. Steve Lobel was our product manager at Relativity. He had Fat Joe and Big Pun and the rest of the Terror Squad in a van driving through the whole America. Because at the time, I was scared to fly. So we drove everywhere to Shaw. We drove to Chicago, Cabrini Greens, with Pink House, DJ Pink House. We drove all around this country eating McDonald's. And we was eating McDonald's. And even when Flojo was like, Flojo was number one in the country. Mm-hmm. It went number one. And I was still getting like $400 a show, $500 a show. It wasn't no real money at the time. Mm-hmm. So it was like a struggle, you know, to get to the next level. But I had left like a fairy tale, and this is no bullshit. I had left the drug game alone when I signed to start rapping, and I refused to go back. Even though my friends were still making literally millions of dollars, they was in Bentleys, they was in all that shit, I wouldn't go back. If somebody got robbed in the crew, I wouldn't go back. If anything, I would not go in there because I knew this was my way out. This is the way I had to go. So I took a real pay cut. So I would do stuff like not only, you know, do my shows, but then I would promote parties. So I would pour KRS. KRS probably came and performed for me 20 times for free in the Bronx. So everybody I ever met, I'd be like, yo, I gave Biggie his first show. Notorious B.I.G., I gave him his first show ever. Yeah, I gave him a G and a bottle of Moet. And he came, and I'm talking about Party and Bullshit just came out.
Oh, okay.
So it's like the first show, B.I.G., Fat Joe. And I was just promoting parties, making a couple of grand on the side, then doing my show. You know, it was real. It was a real struggle.
Yo, I remember an episode of Yo MTV Raps where you had like your own clothing joint, or like you were like one of the first dudes to have your venture in hip hop.
I think
fashion.
I was
what
the
was
second.
It called?
FJ 560.
FJ 560.
How'd you know?
FJ 560. I think
you know everything.
I remember this.
He had the jacket. So what happened? What happened was, and I'm gonna tell you some real shit I never said before, but it was probably the first or the second. I don't know if Wu-Tang had their brand first. It was one or the other.
Now you were first.
But I remember we was making these. So we were making these coats and these snorkels, the leather jackets, almost like the Averixes. And I remember going to a party, and Puffy and Jay-Z walking into the bathroom. I was in the bathroom with FJ 560 snorkels on. And I was like, oh, shit. They was like, yeah, we rocking your shit. And I'm like, all right, cool, yo. But the business partners that I had, they were really, really cheap. They didn't want to really mass produce. They didn't really, really want to market and promote. And we lost our shop. We could have made hundreds of millions of dollars with that line. It was ahead of its time.
Yeah, I wanted to visit that. Like, y'all, I remember you and Freddie were like live at that store. And like, yo. I want to go over there and see that joint. Like, I always wanted to see it and never knew what happened to it.
Hey, Joe.
Okay.
I was just going to ask. I was just kind of curious, since you were talking about you signed your deal in the middle of the street. You were new to the industry. You didn't know anything. Some of those hard lessons that you had to learn on your way. Because now you are the businessman. You know this business in and out. But before, what were like a couple of them hard lessons that you had to learn?
Well, I really ain't gonna lie to you. I did not get jerked by Chris Lighty in the middle of the street. So I was lucky.
Okay, good.
No, I was lucky. He did not jerk me. He was fair with me. Forever Relativity was good to me. But I did get jerked for my publishing. So I had signed a deal with this guy, his name is Jelly Bean Benitez.
Legendary producer.
So he was signing. He was doing music for Madonna and all of them. So he hit me with the
Madonna
yo.
And shit.
He hit me with the yo. We both Latino. This bullshit. And then I met him in 1992. I signed his publishing. He gave me $50,000 when I signed. He been robbing me for that publishing ever since. And I still ain't seen him in like 25 years. And, you know, and so we've been trying to get some type of royalty accounting or whatever. I didn't have my publishing back till around Lean Back. But anything before there, what's that? Wow. Anything I did, the man robbed me for my publishing. Real talk.
Oh, shit. Damn, Benitez.
That's his line.
Damn.
Yeah.
Damn. Donald Passman old, book, everybody. Donald Passman.
My
book.
Good old Latino. My good old Latino brother.
Wait, hold on, Joe, can you talk to like, where like Latino music and hip hop were meeting at that time? I mean, behind you is a giant picture of Hector Lavoe, who's like, we can't ignore that. The king of,
what's your name?
The king of your salsa.
What's your name? Who asked that question?
I'm Bill Sherman.
Yo, Bill, let me tell you something, Bill. Hip hop is black and Latino music from day one. Sure. So if you go to the very inception of hip hop music, the very first block party jam, you will see the Latinos in there and the blacks in there. And they break dancing and they writing graffiti. Latinos is break dancing and writing graffiti. So the black guys was mostly DJing and MCing. And that's the real focal point on it. But if you go to day one and you look in the archives of hip hop, it's always been black and Latino music.
Was it like that though? Sure, go ahead. I'm sorry, Bill.
But for you, like in the house, like was it like, was there Latin records?
Well, me
in one
personally,
corner,
I grew up
records the other corner.
I grew up black, so like I'm a black Latino. Nah, it's real.
No, you got to break that. That's real, but you have to break that down because everybody in the world don't understand what that means.
I grew up black, so like where I grew up was 99.9% black. And Fat Joe had the hairs like the Beatles with green eyes and thought he was black.
Wow.
And because there wasn't no real Latino. So all my girlfriends growing up was black, me, black. If you look at the class pictures, it's me and 30 black people. Like, I think they said the killing of Malcolm X. Who killed Malcolm X? They showed his class picture at one point. He was the only black guy. It was nothing but white people in the whole picture. When he was growing up.
Right.
And that was Fat Joe. So wait,
you said like the Beatles. You mean Mop Head or hippie era?
Yeah, like this. Look, I put up a picture maybe like 2 weeks ago. I found one with my hair like the Beatles, bro. Like the fucking Beatles. Like
Mop Head, damn.
The mushroom.
Okay.
Yeah. And so what happened was nobody told me, yo, you're not black. I don't know how to explain it to y'all. So even though my father's Cuban and my mother's Puerto Rican, you know, my mother speaks English fluently, everything, you know, she grew up on all the Gladys Knight, all the Aretha Franklins, you know, my house every day. We didn't play salsa. We play I Will Survive.
Right.
Oh, now walk out the door. Like, that's the shit we was playing. And it wasn't until I went to high school, and there was no social media. It wasn't even a rap video at that time.
Right.
So when I went to high school, I met a friend of mine. His name was Charlie. He lived on the other side of the Bronx. And when he took me to his hood, I never knew there was so much Puerto Ricans in the Bronx. And this is like 15 minutes away. Wow. So just like me, I met the one black guy. Yeah, then I met the one black guy who thought Puerto he Rican. Was Puerto Rican in that neighborhood. Yeah, he's talking Spanish. Motherfucker black as shit. Oh, que pasa, papi? Hey, hey. He thought he was Puerto Rican, right? So when I went there and I started going to Charlie's house, that's when his mother was like, yo, you're not black. And she started screaming, Hector Lavoe, Gran Combo, Grupo Nietzsche, all the Southside, you know, all the legends. And I'm like, oh, shit. So that's when I got put on to Spanish music, and more so Spanish pride, started finding myself in my culture. Every window I looked at had Puerto Rican flags. I'm talking about 14 flights. Every window had Puerto Rican flags. And they was bumping that salsa shit out the window. They was like this. So that's when I started to learn about Hector Lavoe and salsa music and then Latino heritage. And then from there, I just wanted to learn more and more and more and more. And that's where we at.
Yo, not to fast forward, but just, I got to tell you, based off of that, that's why it was so good to see that episode of She's Gotta Have It when y'all went back to Puerto Rico and really just broke down the connection of, like, the African diaspora to Puerto Rico and how we are all Black and how they, you know, it was just, it was perfection. That must have felt real good
Vinny
to do.
Winnie wins. Yeah, I was going to say.
Winnie wins.
Yo. You know it's Winnie winning the house like a motherfucker.
Wait, all right. Don't now, you? All right.
You killed that
role, man. You bodied that role.
All right, we got to skip.
What the fuck?
How did you, who you channeling with your voice with Benny Wint? Like, that was my favorite character from that show.
All right. Thank God. But listen, let me tell you. Now, I meet a lot of people. I met Chad Boswick, a bunch of actors that say, yo, man, you killed that shit.
You did.
I was like, because, you know, I went hard.
I know.
Y'all went hard, though.
You showed your heart. Like, it was just...
That character, I'm going to tell you the truth, y'all. That was like the 14th member of Wu-Tang. So, they said, this guy got money, got his own strip club, but he's stuck in the past. He still wears Tim's and baggy pants and hoodies and sniffs a little coke. And then I was like, oh, shit. That's like the long-lost member of Wu-Tang. And that's who I modeled Winnie Wynn after. I came up with that whole character. Like, if, you know, he was a member of Wu-Tang. So he's like, yo, what's up? It's Winnie Wynn. I know who the fuck is your engineer. And you know, and that's how I feel when a lot of times when I get around the Wu-Tang, because they all got money, but they be like dressing like it's still 9'3", 9'4".
Yo, straight up, Pelly jackets, yo.
Pelly hoodies. Tim's, I'm like, yo, like, these niggas ain't get the memo. Like, it's like, you know, but that's what Winnie Wynn is based off of.
Do you find that often, especially coming from where you came from and your need to evolve as a person and as an artist, like outgrowing your teen life and your early adult life into where you are now? Was it hard making that transition? Like, was it hard
not really
throwing all those Timberlands away?
I think I'm...
Huh?
No. I still got Tim.
You still got your pink Tim?
I still got Tim.
You still got your pink Tim?
I still got Tim.
Okay.
No, I got Tim.
Pink ones, though?
Dude, he was early. He was an early adapter.
No, I remember.
He was early.
And maybe some
baby blue. First of all, the first transition was... I had to go. I'm writing a book of my life now. When it comes out, y'all read it and y'all get a bigger understanding, right?
Yeah.
But first of all, when I came in the game, I think the biggest transition I had to do was leave the streets behind. So when I came in the game, a lot of people were scared of me hearing my reputation in the streets. So they almost thought like I was going to be the New York Suge Knight, like extort my way or whatever. So I had to win people's trust and never feel like I'm some bully or I'm... That was the first transition I had to make. So I actually was sitting back looking at everybody else act a fool when I knew I could squash everybody, but, you know, try to be a nice guy so these people won't think I'm an animal, right? Mm-hmm. And then we still had that conception of keep it real, keep it real, keep it real. So Fat Joe always had to keep it real, keep it real. Even though I had records like What's Love, when you saw me, I was walking in with 30 street dudes, entourage, ice grilling. You know, so you was like, yo, we had that. I think that was the biggest transition I had to make. And I made it maybe in the last 5 years of my life where I said, you know, fuck, keep it real. Keep it real is making sure my people are fed, my family's good, and let me try to elevate and grow and be this guy you see now where, damn, this guy's a nice guy. Like, we just never knew. And at the time, too, like, I don't want, like, me and Biggie was really tight. Me and Notorious B.I.G. Biggie was really tight. Mm-hmm. I don't have pictures with Biggie because at the time it wasn't cool. You felt like you was a sucker to ask somebody, yo, let's take a picture. Mm-hmm. Right? So I missed out on all that. Right? So, and at that time, even if you liked each other, everybody was ice grilling each other. Yeah. Right? So
I mean,
I had to learn how to smile.
Right.
I had to learn. I had to learn how to smile and be like, all right, yo, let it down. Like, grow. You're getting older. Chill. And that was the biggest transition I had to make from keeping it real. And I lost a lot of money keeping it real because people really didn't want, what I didn't understand is people didn't want to be affiliated with gangsters. Like, you know what I mean? And Joe, let alone we heard rumors he's a gangster, he's coming with 30 gangsters. And you know what I mean? We can't invite Joe. We really want Joe to come to the Hamptons, but we know that guy's coming with 30 street guys and somebody might get robbed in the bathroom in the all-white party. So don't invite Joe.
Man, one question I always wanted to ask you.
No, go ahead. Were you about to ask about who shot you?
Oh.
All right, go ahead.
We can get there. Before we get there, who shot you? Man. So one question I always wanted to ask you just as an MC, Joe. So your trajectory, your progression from Represent the Jealous Ones Envy was like phenomenal. What did you do in terms of stepping your
game? I'm going to tell you what happens.
From that first album to second album.
I'm going to tell you what happens, right? So I came out at a time where Flo Joe went number one in the country. But if you really listen to Flo Joe, I'm going bust it, check it, watch how I wreck it. Niggas watch your back.
Wreck it, yeah.
Shit is getting hectic. Is I getting catch hectic. Vibes like Count Basie. I said, right? So it's like, it was A, B, C, D, E, F, G. It really wasn't lyrical. Mm-hmm. It wasn't nothing. And so you love the song. You love the fact that I was certified by the Digging in the Crates group. You love my history. When you called up your cousins in New York, it was like, no. Them boys is laying it down. Like, they the truth. So you was intrigued. It's similar to, like, Young Jeezy with BMF. When he came out, we was like, yeah. Oh, he's part of it. So it was all that. But I really wasn't dope. So there's a guy who came out. His name was Nas. And I remember sitting in the car. Showbiz came to get me at the Beamer. He was like, yo, Joe, get in the car, come down. So I got in the car, and when he pressed play, and that boy was like, sneaker Uzi on the island in my army, yeah, I can lie in there on the way to Common in the base, half man, half amazing. But it, I was like, it was the most incredible shit I ever heard in my life. But at the same time, it was almost like a morgue or a cemetery for MCs like Fat Joe. It was like, if you do not step your shit up, it is over. It's low Joe, one and done.
So well, I don't think MCs do that anymore, y'all.
Straight up.
They don't
straight
do up. That no more.
They don't. So he pushed the game. He elevated the game to a point of where you couldn't get away with busted checking. So I had to study him. I studied him. I might have listened to that tape. If I say 20 million times, it's not enough. And then Reasonable Doubt came out and all that. So everybody was like, so when Reasonable Doubt came out, I could relate to that more because he was talking that drug dealer life and where I came from. And I said, oh, shit, we could do that? Like, we could talk that drug. So then when I came, hustling is the key to success.
Money is the key to sex.
The life is getting mad, getting dough, getting wet. The game people play. The names, one for the cash, two for every blood, ass, three for all that. Yeah, so then I was like, oh, shit, I could be me. Like, I could really save my life.
So let me ask, all right, since you mentioned him, because I feel like one of your most underrated bangers.
The Incredible?
Was John Blaze.
Oh, yeah, John Blaze, yeah.
Yo,
I mean, when Cosmic Kev played that in Philly, man, he rarely is one of those, I'll play something three times in a row, like the way that Funkmaster Flex does. Like, I got to play it over. But yeah, the day that John Blaze came out with you and Nas was like, that was a moment. So, I mean, how did you feel at that moment when that was actionable, even before I asked
I was at.
Let me go back, because I feel like your moment of really stepping it up for me was Who Shot You? I'm sorry, I Shot You.
I Shot You.
I Shot You. Yeah, I Shot You remix.
How did that even come to be? Because for me, like, the way you ended that line.
Who the fuck you think you're talking to?
Joey Cry, a.k.a. Kaiser Sosa.
Right. Kaiser Sosa.
Like, that, I felt like that was your domino slam moment.
Domino motherfucker.
So how did that come to be?
First of all, LL Cool J is my idol. And I've never backed down. I've never backed down for competition. I've never backed down to this day. And you can be the greatest rapper on earth and I'm gonna go toe-to-toe with him. I've never been scared. It actually elevates me. Like, you ever see, like, Golden State, when they were the best team in the world, they'll play the wackest team and then they'll play whack like them. Mm-hmm. But when it's a big game, they'll shoot shots.
It brings
your
game down.
Yeah, it brings me up. If I get on a song with Jay-Z or Nas or whoever, I'm going. Like, I'm going on another level. I couldn't wait for this moment. So I'm working on my second album. The Trackmasters come in the studio. We had in New York Battery Studio, something. And they come in and they was like, yo, Joe, what's up? And they was like, what you working on? I said, my album. I played him a couple of joints off my album. He's like, yo, we need to ask LL. And that's when I came in with that. Now, who the fuck you think you talking to?
Right.
I pay dues. I spray crews. Look at Joey Crack. Motherfuckers be like, he's that dudes running this racket. From New York to Montego, Soda Revivo. Bringing tons of keys to Puerto Rico. Nah. That was my moment.
Was it all done? Like, were you all
to the next level?
Were you all doing it at the same time, or was it just piecemeal? Like, was Foxy there? Was
John Blaze? No. John Blaze, I did with everybody, but they just gave me the beat, and I just went for mine. You know, that's it.
Because that's the risky thing about doing posse cuts. Because I know oftentimes, and I watch this a lot with Tariq, whenever people ask him, you know, to do stuff or whatever. Recently, Tariq's on a joint with Eminem. And I mean, on Eminem's records, like a posse cut. And Tariq was kind of salty because he had his joint first. And it was like, ah, man, I don't want to be the first guy to submit the verse. Because then they'll, you know, no one wants to be the first guy. So I always wanted to know, how are posse cuts organized? Like, do you hear everyone else's shit? Or do you...
I don't do that.
Me neither.
I'm not going to lie to you, Quest, man. Fat Joe, so underrated. I don't know how to explain it to you, man. I don't listen to nobody's shit. I don't listen to nobody's shit. I go in there and I tell them, play the music. And when they play the music, I write the shit right in their face with my own flow. And I go in there, yo, what's the hook? Boom, I need the beat. I need the hook. The hook is this. All right, so now I know where we going with it. Boom, and I'm going to just go crazy. I never change my verse. I never, I don't know. You know, I'm just not on it like that. I just, you know me, I fight for my life every time. So every time I write like it's the last song I'm going to ever do in my life. Like, I might die today. And that's just my strategy. That's always been my strategy. So that means I give it 2,000% every time I rap. So I'm never worried like that. But not like that. But
you got to treat every verse. I was saying, you got to treat every verse like it's the first time somebody might be hearing you. You know what I'm saying? That's kind of been my lesson just as moving along. When we did,
and you know, every time you
on the track with whoever.
And you also got to know that anytime a young artist asks you to get on it, you know they want to give you a can of whoop ass. So you really got to pay attention and spit that shit. Because you know that's how it is. It's just like boxing. Motherfucker take a boxing degree. Motherfucker Mike Tyson was killing niggas in 12 seconds. But when he was already 30-some years old looking for that check, they was using him to beat him up and look like they somebody ill. You know, and that's pretty much what a young dude would do. If a hot young dude says, crack, let's get on the record. Like, I did two songs with the Griselda Boys. I went crazy. I'm not going to let them rip me down. I'm just not. Like, I'm a go for mine crazy. I mean, the only person I let my guard down with, and she don't like me to say this, is Remy.
Remy, yeah.
She's the only person I don't feel competition with. She's the only person. I don't care if she beats me. You know, I rap, and let her. I want her to always shine no matter what. You know, that's
I was
just,
about to say, why Remy? Why is it? What is it about Remy? Because you didn't rhyme with other brothers, other sisters, but what is it about Remy?
It's just she's my sister, for real. Like, sister? You know what I mean? So I want her to sound great anyway. I'm not talking about I'm taking it easy on Remy. I'm not saying that. I'm spitting my best shit. But I don't get mad if Remy beats me on the... If she's... We did that remix with Jay-Z. She went, ain't shit, bro.
Right.
Like, bananas. I was happy.
Can you just tell us the first time you heard Remy? Like, what was it? When did she stop you in your tracks?
Unreal. Pun said, y'all, I want you to meet somebody. And he brought her to the studio. She came in. I never forget. She was so skinny. She had the leather vest. And we played a beat. And she rapped for like 10 minutes straight. The air bubbles in your sneakers. I'm troubled. Raye's my brother. This, and I was so amazed. But I was jealous. And I was mad. Because I was like, damn. Pun discovered her. She going to be pun artist. Like, I wish she was my artist.
Right.
So I was mad. I stood quiet. Punk could see that I was mad. She tells me the story. She says, yo, bro, you ice grilled me for like 10 minutes. I was really mad. I was in there like, yo, shit, I wish I discovered her. Why she ain't come up to me? And then when we walked out the studio, Punk hugs me and says, I know, twin, don't worry. She going to be your artist. Don't worry. She's your artist.
How did you meet Pun?
I went to a bodega writing my projects that I always used to go to. And they was just out there. It was him and like three other guys freestyling. So I came out with a Diet Pepsi. I had my Diet Pepsi. And I looked at him and I was like, yo, what is this fatter Spanish dude gonna spit about? Like, I was just like, what the fuck is this nigga gonna talk about?
Right.
And so I walked up and he said, chill, y'all, chill, chill, chill. He was obviously the leader. And so he starts rapping. And he's like, da 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 da. Stop, like, he stopped the car set. Pull the moon out the sky and blow the sun away. Me and my niggas playing hardcore lyrics till I'm feeling breaking God door, my front door, but I gotta do it. So I was like, I could not take it. I ran to the passenger side. I had a white Lexus, LS400, and I opened the door. I said, please, get inside. Please. Got in the car. We locked the door. And that was just beautiful because I'm the youngest brother. I'm the youngest kid in my family. But I never had a little brother. And Pun never had a big brother. Mm-hmm. I realized Pun was like, yo, you're going to be my big brother. You're going to be my big brother. I'm going to be your brother. And, you know, you got to have my back. And I said, I got your back. And then he started telling me about his life. Real, real personal, deep shit. You know, Pun was homeless growing up. You know, nobody gave a fuck about him. And he told me all that. Just ripped it up. And me, coming from the streets before I even rap. The rap shit is even faker. But coming from the streets, where I see men that, you know, killers and murderers and all type of people, I had never met a person who could just open up himself and his pain. First time I met him and there, and I was just like, nah, I love this dude, man. I fuck with him on another level. And that's how I met Pun.
Wow. You know, Bill, unpaid Bill here, and I are a part of the team that worked on Hamilton. And I know that, you know, anytime Lin-Manuel does an interview about who his lyrical inspiration was to put Hamilton together, he won't hesitate to say, like, how important Big Pun's lyrical style was just on his life and just, you know, culturally and all those things. Like,
oh, for sure.
You know, I almost wonder, like, what Hamilton would just be a regular Broadway show if it weren't
this,
for Big Pun.
To this day, Dead in the Middle of Little Italy, blah, 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 is one of his favorite. Yeah. Because internal rhyme was always is his thing and everything, and so that always we used to listen to that a lot. That record was on auto spin at our house.
That was his hero. Like he.
I mean, you know, Big Pun.
Little did we know that we riddled two middlemen who didn't do diddly.
Yeah, man.
You know, Dead in the Middle of Little Italy almost wasn't Dead in the Middle of Little Italy. So like. Pun was so advanced that it was a joke to him. Dead in the Middle of Little Italy was actually a joke he would say. Like, he put it on the album too, packing the Mac in the back of the act,
I want to ask you about that. What? Because to me, that is my favorite. That is one of my favorite skits on a hip hop record. Only because I know that he was reenacting the Scarface scene. Where he lets the one guy go and the one guy's like, thanks, Pun, I appreciate it. And he runs off. Like, but literally, what was the deal with packing a Mac in the back of the act?
For one, now that we floating in this era, we were unconscious. We was like, we was numb. We were crazy, man. We was just fucking crazy. I don't know how to explain it to you. And stuff that you can, if you think about regular people, I thought, you know, when I grew up seeing death. Maybe I had 40 guys I grew up with, 38 of them got killed. Real shit. Before they 20 years old, 21. So, and when I meet regular people who didn't have friends dying at 16, I'm like, then I start saying like, damn, some of the shit we done said in music, like, motherfuckers, like, with a normal life, is like, yo, what the fuck is wrong with them? Because he's saying, packing the Mac in the back of the act. It's all about machine gun. Packing the Mac in the back of the act, yeah. Packing the back. And so that was the joke. And then in the middle of Little Italy was the other joke. Then in the middle of Little Italy. So when we did the song together, I said, yo, you got to put that dead in. I swear to God on everything. You got to put that dead in the middle. He was like, yo, that shit whack, nigga. That shit is a joke. That shit, I said, Pun, that shit will blow their minds off. He was like, no, I'm telling you, that shit regular, that shit, but that's a joke. And and I gassed him to put it in that motherfucker. And man, you know, he was, you know, this guy's born. Jay-Z was born. Nas was born. Eminem was born. Big Pun was born. I'm trying to think of others. I guess Rakim was born. There is no other job description for these people. Mm-hmm. Like, they were born to do that. Like, there's just no, that is the DNA. Their birth was on that. Pun would fall asleep, wake up and be like, give me the book, twin. Give me the book. That's crazy because I got paper and pen right here. He said, he goes, wow. Give me the book, twin. And I give him the book. He write a whole song down. He thought about it in his dreams and write the whole song down. It's crazy, man. The guy was a genius. There's just no way around it.
And his breath control was kind of like crazy. I don't understand how he did all that and then still the breath control.
Right. He's a big guy.
Yeah. But still rhymed faster than most, you know.
He would do it on stage. You know, Pun was different. Like, you know how you see boxers? It's crazy. I keep referring back to boxing. But you know how you see boxers that's so nice that nobody wants to fight them? So they can't really get a real fight because you know you'll get knocked out. Pun would invite every rapper to the studio to do a song with him and no one would show up.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So we would drive around, me and Pun, and he would see like a cipher of up-and-coming rappers battling each other. And he would get out the car, double platinum, rich, and battle the whole cipher. Like,
wow.
You know, nobody wanted smoke with Pun. I don't know how to explain it to you. In no way, shape, or form did anybody want smoke with this guy. They could say whatever,
right,
forget him, whatever you want. But nobody, when he was alive, people were going, don't let him on. Don't let him on. Form Master Flex used to have these ciphers. And every week he would bring rappers up there. So one week is Nori up there, Cam'ron, Nori, Cam'ron, I think DMX and somebody else, right? And Pun hears it and starts racing down from the Bronx to Hot 97. So Pun is calling the hotline. Pun calls, Flex picks up. He's like, yo, you got to let me up there. So Flex said, this is a true story. Flex said he looked at everybody up there and was like, yo, Pun is on his way. He said they was like, no, don't let him on this motherfucker, please. So then Pun arrives to Hot 97. He's calling Flex a million times. Flex don't pick up the phone. They freestyling up there. So Pun calls me, yo, Twin, this nigga Flex won't let me up there, this, that. So then later on, I got with Flex and I asked him the truth. I was like, yo, Flex, why you ain't let Pun up there? He said, yo, they were scared to death. They didn't want to let Pun up there on that cipher. They didn't want him up there. And we talking about big guys, Cam'ron, DMX, yeah. Nori. At their prime, they was like, hell no, don't let that boy up here. He going to come up in there, but da 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 da. It is. I got to go. Love y'all, man.
Can
I'll talk to y'all.
Can we do a part two to this so we can make it official?
Do a part two, whatever you want, man. I'm here.
Yo, for sure. Peace, Joe.
All right. Part two coming.
All right. Thank you.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.